land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be.
Well, good evening. Welcome to Yada Yada Radio. I'm here with Kirk, and boy, the world has taken quite a tumble in the last week, Kirk. Ramadan must be approaching because Muslims are more deadly than ever. You always know that it's Ramadan. You know, Christmas Christians open Christmas presents and at Christmas time, and Jews light candles at Hanukkah, and Muslims murder at Ramadan. There are more Jews that have been killed in the last week by crazed Muslims than any time in the last decade or so. And while that's bad, because most of these buffoons are young men with assault rifles that are just gunning down women, children, old men, going buses, shooting at cars, past. They have no idea who it is. They're just universal hatred based exclusively on race. Stupid is as stupid does. But it's worse because most all of the Islamic media outlets and governments are applauding them. They're calling the shooters and murderers heroes. They're talking about the martyrdom operation that took place in a community where they killed a well, there's no such thing as a Palestinian, but he was an Arab Christian that was a cop, and he was the one that actually killed the Islamic terrorist. And so they're bragging about that. So that's the same race that they are. But no, it doesn't. Still, that in their view, they were killing a settler. There were no settlers here. They also killed two Ukrainians, not ethnically Jews, just Ukrainians that were there working. But never mind. It doesn't matter. They're heroes. Can you imagine turning over part of your country and thinking it's going to work out really well? Having these idiots with their own state so they can have as many weapons as they want, and the world, you know, particularly this point? Current administration in Washington, is encouraging that. And I don't know how you could be that stupid. So Israel's a real mess. Inflation, oh my goodness. We had, you know, destroyed the value of the dollar and our economy with the moronic approach to COVID by leftist governments. And then we tried to spend our way out of it by printing great amounts of money, trillions upon trillions of dollars, maybe $10 trillion. And that made a bad situation worse. So now we're trying to tax our way out of it by removing all incentive. That will make a bad situation even badder. And on top of that, then Biden decides that he wants to provoke Russia by issuing all sorts of sanctions. And not smart enough to realize that it's just like these buffoons that tried to determine what was a necessary occupation.
Entry, yeah.
Which mm-hmm. one was essential and what was not. Well, they're all essential. That's just the way an economy works. You may not think the guy that makes the cardboard is essential until you need to ship the syringes or the masks. You may not think that the truck driver is essential until you need to get it there. You may not think the farmer is essential until you need to eat something. You may not think that the grocer is essential until you need food on the table. So what about the guy that produces the parts for the truck that makes the delivery? And anyway, so we're not smart enough, and I want to tell you, this current president, he is way too old and senile to be leading any nation, geriatrics. But he decided he was going to sanction Russia. So first thing he does is ban Russian oil in the United States. Now, Russia's got plenty of places to sell oil. It doesn't matter to them at all. All we did is double the price of oil. So that on top of every other inflation woe, we're now paying, I go to the pump now, it's $5 a gallon.
And it's close to $7 here.
And that's just strictly because of Biden's stupidity. And then you try to buy something in the store. My wife compared receipts this last week versus several months ago. The least anything increased in price was 20%. Many things were up 40%. The average was closer to 30. I mean, that's the kind of inflation that turns to anarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pervasive throughout Europe as well. One of the problems, of course, is that Russia is one of the largest producers and exporters of fertilizers in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Without fertilizer, you can't grow crops. Without crops, you have a food shortage. Can produce costs much more. Fertilizer now costs 4 to 5 times what it previously did, and so your produce of the market is hugely increased. So food's becoming unaffordable, and the shelves are going empty. We're eventually going to have a food shortage. Europe is already rationing both food and energy. These are the kinds of stuff that cause revolutions. So we got Israel that's being bludgeoned by Islamic terrorists. No one seems to care. We have runaway inflation, and everyone seems comatose to it. Biden had a couple of enormous gaffes over the past week. One was he called for the overthrow of Putin after name-calling.
You're kidding?
And then given every opportunity to back off of that, because the United States has a really bad habit of offing heads of state, he said, it was my moral outrage. But where was your moral outrage when we were cluster bombing Iraq? Where was your moral outrage when we bombed Libya back to the Stone Age? Was his moral outrage. Where was his moral outrage when we took the Gatling guns on Apache helicopters and gunned down men, women, and children, civilians in the streets of Afghanistan, and then called them terrorists? Then on top of that, in the same press conference, he went on this whole rant and saying that sanctions are not a deterrent. Everyone knows that sanctions are not a deterrent. Then why did you impose them? He said to create pain.
To whom?
You know the kind of people that create pain as a purpose? They call them sadists.
Sadists, I was saying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Somebody that creates pain is a... has Asperger's. They have no empathy. It's the kind of stuff that is inherent in psychopaths. Welcome to America. Academy Awards was interesting this past week. You may have heard. I don't watch such things, but I did see the video clip of it. The Will Smith, who has always had this undercurrent of about ready to explode. Chris Rock makes a joke about his sort of wife with her shaved hair. She's ever got some kind of a disease that causes hair to fall out, and she decided to shave it. And of course, in today's world, with women trying to look like men and women trying to look like women, a shaved head is kind of her feminist thing anyway. I mean, if she was cared about it, she'd have worn a wig. But nonetheless, she had a shaved head. And he made a comment, you know, looked like G.I. Jane. And Will Smith laughs about it. Then about a minute or two later, and I say it's sort of wife. I mean, his wife is screwing everything
that
walks.
Open marriage.
Oh, yeah, screws everything that walks. So, and, you know, he's not really married. But anyway, he wanted to prove his manliness, I guess. He walks up and he hits, damn near knocks him out, Chris Rock, then walks back to his seat and starts swearing at him. Now, if the Hollywood elite, the Academy Awards producers, were sane, had a moral fiber in their body, they would have arrested Will Smith right there.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you can model behavior where a person walks up and hits another, oh, by the way, where was Black Lives Matter? Of course, it was a black person hitting another black person. I guess they don't care.
Okay.
We overlook those things. But nonetheless, the police said, you know, we should arrest him. That's battery. Felony battery. And they said no. What kind of a message is that? If they had done the right thing, there was a message for the young people of this world, particularly young black people, to see you can't do that. There's a consequence. But by doing nothing, they showed that they've absolutely lost their ability to be moral. It was reprehensible.
Mm-hmm.
Next item in the news is Russia and the Ukraine. I've stopped trying to pay any attention to news reports because I don't think I've ever seen such propaganda, such biased reporting. We've essentially said we don't want to hear anything one side has to say, and we don't care what the other side has to say. We're going to make it noble, even if the fighters are neo-Nazis, even if by our actions we are empowering Nazis to a greater degree than was done in Hitler in Germany prior to Hitler's rise to power, with more neo-Nazis better armed in the Ukraine than there were brown shirts in Germany. The scariest thing about all this is that one thing I do look at from time to time is the photographic evidence. And it's scorched earth. It is apparent that the United States' decision to give the Ukrainians enormous amounts of very sophisticated weapons, missiles and the like, that they have wreaked such havoc on the Russians that the Russians are saying, oh, the hell with it. The only thing that we can do without endangering our own people is to lob artillery shells at a distance. And now you look at the bridges, you look at the housing, you look at the municipal buildings, you look at the roadways, you look at everything. It's scorched earth. And why were we not able to see that the consequence of arming one side against the other was going to be carnage? And that's what we witness. There is all sorts of rumors that Russia is retreating, that Russia is going to fall back. And it might happen. But, and I don't claim to be an expert, and I don't want to project onto Putin, because that's one of the things that really disgusts me about all this, is that nobody seems to be able to talk about this as a fight based upon political objectives and military objectives, particularly with the growth of NATO along the Russian border and how it has historical precedents that we ignored. But it's pretty obvious that Putin is not the kind of guy that loses nicely. He's not Jack Nicklaus or Arnold Palmer. Jack Nicklaus or Arnold Palmer would lose a major tournament by one stroke, and they would walk up to the guy that beat him and put their arm around their shoulder and said, good job, man. You got me this time. I'll try to get you next time. You put up a good fight. I'm proud of you. That's not Putin. Nobody thinks that's Putin. And so if we supplied enough weapons to the Ukraine to prevent Russia from prevailing, such that they took enormous losses and they retreat, what do you think is going to happen? Does anybody bother to think this through? Do you think that Putin is just going to go take a nap? He's going to say, I'm so sorry. I should have done it. Please forgive me. Do you think there's any chance of that happening?
No, sir.
Particularly with all the pain we've inflicted. What do you think he's going to do? You think he's going to go off and live in that fancy house he built on the Black Sea? No. The marked man. His at this point, he is going to inflict pain on the country that inflicted his pain. And the boy has enough nuclear weapons to destroy the planet probably 100 times over. We ever think this through? How is this going to end in anything other than world war? And why is it that we think that we can increase the size of our military and somehow be safe from Russia and China? Do we think at all? Do you think there's one possibility in a trillion billion that China or Russia are going to try to invade the United States, or any country is going to try to invade the United States?
No.
Projecting a force across the ocean to do that?
Can't be done.
I mean, other than the Mexicans running across the U.S. border. But they're coming to work in fields and homes, No, there is no chance. There isn't any scenario where that's going to happen. And by the same token, do you think there's any chance the United States could invade Russia or China and prevail? Heck, we got our butts kicked in Afghanistan and Iran, and neither country had an army. Neither country had a military.
No Air Force, nothing.
Nothing.
Yep.
We got our clock cleaned. So how is it that we think we're going to prevail against Russia or China? We could spend 10 times our GDP on our military for the next 100 years, and we still couldn't prevail.
By the way, they both
have nuclear bombs. They would respond.
Yeah. Yes, they will.
And, of course, in the midst of all this, we've given Iran a free hand, because one of the things about progressives is they can't think. And so all they want is a deal with Iran. They don't give a crap that it guarantees that Iran will have a bomb and that they will use it. Or that Iran is the one country that is gleefully trying to destroy the United States and Israel. Well, that's the world we're looking at. The last time that the chosen people were in this big a mess, they were guests of the Egyptians being beaten to death as slaves. The event that freed them was Passover. We're celebrating Passover a week from tonight. I guess there's different times that different folks will choose to celebrate. We're actually going to celebrate it twice in our situation. My youngest son is flying in with his girlfriend on. They're taking the red eye on Friday. They'll be here Saturday. And so we decided that we would have Passover on matzah, So we have a double opportunity. We always do that anyway. We actually love the Passover meal so much. We have the Passover meal on matzah as well.
Mm-hmm.
So this year we're just going to celebrate two Passovers. I don't think y'all's going to be disappointed, but not encourage anybody to follow my example, but that's what we're going to do. So we'll be with you this time next week as we have an early Passover as a family here on in the U.S. Virgin Islands. All right, this time last week. Kirk, you wanted to talk a little bit about the U.S. currency. You had some other things that you read in the news. What were they?
Well, I was going to just get your take on how quick the dollar has fallen, because I don't see how I can recover from this, because you've already got, as a reserve currency, it was everybody's supposed to use it. It's gone from 90-something percent of every transaction in the world through U.S. dollars now to around 47%. And Saudi Arabia agreed, which is supposed to be in our back pocket, agreed to accept yuan for oil. Germany actually was offered by Russia they could buy oil for rubles, and the premier, whatever it is,
that wasn't much of an offer. Putin said, "You want our oil? You're going to pay for it in rubles." Yep.
But if they had enough rubles in their bank, they could say, okay.
Wasn't much of an offer. Russia has been very aggressive in cryptocurrency and many other countries around the world. I want our listeners to have an appreciation for what this means. The only reason that America has been able to to the tune of well over $30 trillion. And continue to create the illusion of money. We don't even sell our bonds anymore. We have quantitative easing where the Federal Reserve pretends to loan the money by creating its own pretend money to pretend loan the money so that it looks like it's an actual transaction. It isn't. But nonetheless, they're making interest on what now is 30 plus trillions of dollars. The only reason that the U.S. can do that, as has been able to do that, and it is going to come to roost. It's just a matter of time between the illusion that our currency has any value and people recognizing that it's a net liability, it has no value. That's all going to occur within the next 10 years, maybe sooner. But what the reserve currency does is, because the dollar was so dominant, almost all international transactions, as you said, almost 98% of all foreign transactions, when China bought something from Russia, they paid in dollars. It was the reserve currency. It was the currency of international trade. It was. It's why Yahweh refers to the United States as Carthage when he's talking about his prophecy. We are compared to Carthage, who was in a similar position. They controlled through their international ports, their military bases around the world, and by being the de facto reserve currency of the world. The moment the United States loses, and I've talked about this now for more than 10 years, the moment the United States loses this reserve currency status, the illusion of our economy having value disintegrates. And so for us to have fallen from 98% to 47% in this short period of time is just catastrophic, because the illusion cannot survive it. So that's a very, very important discovery, and it should be frightening. But so should runaway inflation, and they are absolutely not sharing the correct information. And runaway inflation has a multiple effect. One is it devalues every asset. It makes it very, very difficult for people to buy and sell things and for anybody to own anything. But it has an exceedingly negative effect on the value of the currency, because what you have to do is, on that $30-plus trillion at 10% interest, it's $3 trillion a year.
Yes.
And you're certain going to be at $3-5 trillion a year on just servicing the debt. Get nothing for it, just servicing the debt that you're adding to the deficit. And so the deficit will grow every other year by $6-8 trillion. It's a runaway. So it's like a lot of things. There is no equilibrium here. Once you pivot, it's a total and complete chaos. But this is what we ought to expect. God describes the last years on this planet as hellish. And so we are in for a rough ride. So yeah. What else did you learn besides the failure of U.S. Dollar as the world's reserve currency?
Well, also, it brought to mind when I was in Brazil, in Terranau in Brazil years ago, we'd staying at the Real Palace in Ipanema Beach in Copacabana right there, and it was wonderful. But I would walk out and pass the desk, and I would start out the day by throwing up a $10 bill when we walked out the door. And inflation was so bad there that they would trade me as many cacheros as I needed that day. Whatever you could name your price, and 20 people would bid on it so they could turn around and go buy groceries immediately to get the stuff and put it in the house because the dollar has nothing. And we would buy something, it'd get change, and we would say, let me give you the change for that, like a dollar and a half, give you 50 cents. They say, we don't want to change. Keep it, throw it away.
Yeah, throw it away.
I can't. You can't live like that.
No, you're taking wheelbarrows to buy a loaf of bread. It ultimately is what led to the chaos in Germany. And when you have economic chaos, where you have runaway inflation, when you have food shortages, when you have a meltdown of the economy.
How do you trade?
What you end up having is world war. By the way, I was reading in the chat room. My buddy Steve goes by Bloodbath in the chat room. He's the one that posts these shows on YouTube. He made a comment. He says matzah and Pesach start on the same day, technically. That is quite correct. It is a point that we ought to reinforce. The event is really Chag Matzah. This is the antithesis of what rabbis and religious Jews observe. Rabbis and religious Jews have made Passover a cultural and religious event bearing no resemblance whatsoever to Yahweh's instructions, being the smallest portion on the plate is the one thing that matters, which is the lamb. No understanding that Pesach represents the doorway to life, and of course no understanding that Yahweh did as he had promised Abraham, and he provided the Passover lamb. That was the fellow that whose name shall not be mentioned, that they despise more than life itself. But matzah is the most essential part, actually, of the celebration, because to have eternal life, which is what Passover provides, and still be corrupted because you haven't availed yourself of matzah, is to spend eternity in Sheol. It's a very it's a counterproductive idea. So it is important to recognize they are the same day, because the entire celebration is called Chag Matzah. And matzah specifically symbolizes the removal of religion and politics from the corruption and perversion of Yahweh's ways by these two institutions in particular from our lives, so that we are perfected on this day, so that Yahweh can adopt us into his family. So matzah and Pesach are inseparable events. And, of course, the reward is Bikurim, where we are adopted into Yahweh's family. And I even think, you know, for a long time, I always was a bit uncomfortable with the term adopted into Yahweh's family, because it was fine for us Goyim to say that as a goy, by accepting Pesach and matzah, by accepting the five conditions of the covenant, were adopted into God's family. The Yehudim and Yisraelites were the ones who were naturally born. But that's really not true. And the reason it's not true is that while that was the intent when Israelites became so rebellious against God, and the book of Hosea, God says, you are not my children.
Divorced.
You are not my children. He speaks of a divorce of Israel, but and the divorce certainly has overtones that are interesting. But if it was a real divorce, then Yahweh could not remarry Israel. The Torah prevents that. So the issue isn't a divorce in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
What he can do, though, is he can marry somebody new. And so for as bad as Jews have been, for as long as they've been bad, for them to be reconciled back into the family relationship, they have to change. They become new and different. But the God's not – the metaphor of divorce is interesting just because the covenant is a family relationship and there is this concept of a marriage vow. But the underwriting tone and the actual verbiage of Hosea is, you are not my people. But he says there a time will come when you will be my people again. So even Israel is adopted in the end because they have estranged themselves. So we're all adopted into the covenant at this point, puts us all on the same footing.
So don't forget the Purim.
Yeah. Anything more you wanted to add on the news side before we
The only thing was that I hadn't realized that we were so close to there's Congress is talking about an e-cash act, so they want to turn everything to electric money. I don't know how you deal with that either. I mean, then you have no control at all. I mean, what do we do? Turn everything over to them? They just allot it accordingly?
The Great Reset. Yahweh's already had one Great Reset. He called it the Flood. That was Yahweh's Great Reset. We're soon going to engage in the Great Renewal, but it isn't a reset. The reset was the Flood. The Great Renewal is his return. But world leaders have been, the World Economic Council in particular, has been pushing for the Great Reset for some time. That's the name of what they're planning to do. And I've been talking about this now for 20 years, long before... Mm-hmm. I even think before there was a World Economic Council, certainly before this concept of a Great Reset was created. And what I have long recognized is that the way you get people to go along with the fact that they're giving up all of their currency, wiping out their bank accounts clean, is you just forgive their debt. You say your credit card debt goes away, your house mortgage loan goes away, your car debt goes away. We'll just wipe out all of your debt. Just accept our new currency as the only legal tender, and you will get 99% of people like lemmings to play along. But that thought process, of course, was pre-COVID, where then I watched 99% of the people give up their freedoms and livelihoods based upon nothing but fear-mongering. So it doesn't really take much to get people to relinquish their freedom and their livelihoods. Anyway, that's what's going to happen, and people worldwide will accept this, and it will be designed to create if not a one world, certainly regional governments where the government has absolute say on how much money you have, how much you're paid, how much you get to keep, what you can buy, where you can go. You now are completely and totally controlled and restricted. And it's one of the things that is not well understood. The difference between the three principal forms of economic governance are communism, fascism, and free enterprise, with socialism being a softened version of communism. The the all three use capital. So they're all capitalistic.
Yeah, they're all capitalistic.
They all use capital, which are two things. One, capital is money, and capital is manpower, and capital is resources. They all use capital. The difference is how those resources are controlled. That's the only difference, is in control. And just as energy equals matter, just its different amounts of energy is the same thing as matter, it's just not the same amount. The quantity is different. Equals mc squared. You got to multiply matter by the square of the speed of light to equal the same amount of energy. So control and capital, money and control, are essentially the same thing. Money gives you the ability to do what you want to do. Control without money gives you the ability to do what you want to do. You can control people with money, or you can control people with politics and power or religion. Control and money are fungible, but they are the same, different sides of the same coin. And so in a communist system, all control is centrally located, so that you have essentially what we had during COVID, where you had a bunch of numbskulls dictating down to the rest of us, who none of whom were smart enough to have ever asked if you want fries with that burger. That's what we had. So that is communism. The people at the top make decisions for everybody else. There is no incentive, which is why nobody works hard. There is no inventiveness, because there is no incentive. There are no new businesses created, because you can't own a business. But that's communism. Fascism is, and with communism, you can't own anything. You own nothing.
That's the people. That's all
right.
The people.
And you as a person are owned by the state in communism.
Mm-hmm.
In fascism, which is what Europe was when the Roman Catholic Church was empowered, it was the serfs. Fascism is what Mussolini declared that he was when he became a failed communist. He said, okay, you don't like me as a communist, I'm now a fascist. And what the fascism enabled him to do is to tell his cronies, like the mafia, oh, you can own whatever you want. I get to make the decision about what you do with it. So I can tell you whether you can live in your home, or I get to live in your home. I can tell you what you do with your factory, or what you don't do it. I can tell you how much of your money I can confiscate, or how much you can keep. Depending on how you please me, I will determine what I'm going to do with you. Power is totally concentrated, but there is still some ownership. That's fascism. Fascism and communism are exceedingly similar in that regard. And in free enterprise, each individual has the opportunity to make their own decisions and be responsible and accountable for their own success or failure. It is by far the most effective form of economic governance that ever conceived by humankind. Now, just recently, I think it's this past week, the Biden administration made a decision that they were going to spend a lot more money on their military. God knows why. Russia's not going to invade us. We're not invading Russia. We're not going to invade China. China's not going to invade us. But if you have a really big military, it's really hard to have a revolution when everybody gets hungry and frustrated with their government. I guess that's the reason. But nonetheless, the way he's going to pay for it is he had his new billionaire tax, but it was really for millionaires, even though he called it a billionaire tax. And what he decided to do to collect more money is he was going to tax unrealized gains.
Yeah.
If you owned a house and it's appreciated in value, you would owe the government 40% of the appreciation of that house as a tax. Now, it's only appreciated in value because the money is devalued by their grotesque spending. And so the more they spend, the more they make the currency worthless, the more the price goes up, not because it's more valuable, but because the money is being demarcated and is worthless, they will tax their own stupidity. Unrealized gains. You might as well say, what's yours is mine. I'm just going to steal it all. But if there's no incentive, then what? I mean, these buffoons, they do not think. But nonetheless, that is what they have promised. There is no hope. There is no salvation. There is no plan. There is nothing. It's going to be constant degradation and decay, chaos, rumors, wars, exactly what Yahweh said was going to occur, very things we read about last week. The chapter that we have been covering is third from the last, and the third and last volume of An Introduction to God. By the way, it is published. Not only published, I have mine sitting right here on my bookshelf. It's called Torah, Volume 3 of ITG. And, well, to call it a book, it's darn near a book of books. It's 700-plus pages long. So I think we reached the absolute max that that Amazon will print. And so I had to exclude a chapter, and Jackie had to narrow the margins. But nonetheless,
well done, Jackie.
We got her done. So the
Did you come with a magnifying glass.
Yeah, the Introduction to God series is now complete, and so we are covering the Yaketz El chapter in it. Yaketz El, we're in it because I made a decision in that volume that I would cover what was said about the Torah in the prophets and in the Mizmor and the Psalms. And so we're going through what is revealed in them. And so there were some very interesting Torah references in Yaketz El that are important to know, because it's one thing for God to say, this is my Torah, it's everlasting, my source of teaching and guidance. It is the only explanation of how you participate in the covenant, which is the only way to have a relationship with me. It's the only place you can read about the invitations to meet with God and to be made immortal and perfected and adopted into his family, enriched and empowered, ultimately reconciled to camp out with him. Only place where all that is. It's one thing, and we did. I had a whole volume dedicated to just that. And then I decided I would write a volume just dedicated to what the prophets had to say, because if the prophets are talking about the Torah still being in effect and to the last days, then you know that Torah wasn't replaced. You might as well throw away your Talmud, your New Testament, and Quran, because God's saying that, no, the original document, the Torah, is what I meant to say, and I'm not changing it.
But I'm still saying. Yeah.
Yes. But it's also was interesting that every time we came across Torah, Yahweh said, the reason my people are estranged from me, the reason my people are ultimately going to be destroyed by me. I'm going to give up on them. I'm going to end up wiping out the vast majority of them. It's because the religious, the rabbis, have corrupted my Torah with their Talmud. And God views that as inexcusable. They've corrupted his name, so they've written his name out of his testimony, and they have replaced his testimony with their Talmud so badly that they actually call their Talmud Torah. So this is something that's very irritating to God. I'd like to turn to one other item in the news, just because I was thinking about it as I was sharing this with you.
Okay.
I was sent an article this week. It is the most, if it all pans out the way that it appears, it is perhaps the most important discovery since the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's a tiny little thing. It is a piece of folded lead found on Mount Ebal. It is just over a centimeter long, by a centimeter. It's tiny. So what could be the big deal? A piece of lead that's essentially a centimeter square folded over. Well, let me tell you what the big deal is. The extension of the Torah goes through the book of Yahusha, known as Joshua. And in Devarim, and then and again in the book of Yahusha, Joshua, there is this presentation of curses and blessings, where Yahweh says, as a good parent, if you do this, these good things, if you follow my advice, all these wonderful things are going to happen to you. If you choose to ignore my advice, if you choose to reject me, and you go off and flirt around and futz around with fake gods, well, bad stuff's going to happen, and you're going to regret it. There's a consequence for doing those things. So, at one point in Yahusha, the eighth chapter, he had half of the people on one side of a valley, the other half on the other, and the place is known as Mount Ebal. And on Mount Ebal, there were the shouting out of curses. If you know, if we do these things, these bad things are going to happen. So get what they found on Mount Ebal.
A curse.
They found a piece of lead, the first time ever written with the very alphabet that we've been sharing. With these,
oh, I didn't know that, really. Wow.
They called it a ox's head because evidently they've never known.
They don't know what a ram's head is.
It's a ram's head. It's got the yod is the outstretched hand. It's the exact same letters that we've been sharing, which were the original letters before it was written. This is now dating to the time of Yahusha when he was on Mount Ebal, talking about the curses, and we found a piece of lead that has the original script, that original alphabet, pressed into it on that mountain that speaks of Yahweh's name. The hay, by the way, is a person standing up. It's just like the hay that we've been using. And it affirms they were there doing that very thing at that very time, using that very language.
That
dating,
is too cool.
Dating to the time of the Exodus of Moses and of Yahusha. And so it's just stunning because it completely destroys the myth of the with the JDEP, you know, that there was a Jehovah's and an Elohimist and a priestess and a Elohimist and a Deuteronomist, that's the other one.
Deuteronomist.
You know, they wrote the four different
like
people and they all wrote their kind of thing and they blended it together and it came out sometime in the Second Temple period.
Yeah.
Predates that by like 600 years. So Finkelstein and all of these theorists, gone.
Yay. This is great.
Anybody, they would also say, there's no way that the Torah could have been written down at that time. It's all a myth because there was no alphabet.
No.
Guess
what, pal? Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm looking at the script here. The hay is the hay, the tent peg. And yow, it's the tent peg. The outstretched arm and hand. It's actually reversed in terms of right to left on this, but it could be reversed because we're looking at, the 10 was pressed through the other side.
Yeah, I get it.
But there it all is. And each word is spelled correctly. And there are alephs all over the place, as a ram's head. It's And I'm looking at pictures of it. So there's no make-believe here. All of the research has been done. It's been everything but peer-reviewed. But, you know, my son wrote a dissertation, and I can tell you that the person who peer-reviewed his dissertation didn't know 5% of what he knew about the particular research he was doing. And I listened to these fellows present this. It's just stunning in terms of its import, and so reassuring for us because of the timeline, because of the alphabet that was used. So we'll keep you attuned to what they to have to say. There's even more they're going to release. This particular tablet, the part that was that they're releasing, and it's a fraction of what's on this thing. It's Kirk. It reads cursed, cursed, cursed. Reason there's a lot of alephs here is cursed is Allah in Hebrew, so it starts with an aleph. Cursed, 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 cursed by the God Yahweh, you will die cursed, cursed, you will surely die, cursed by Yahweh, cursed, cursed, cursed. Now, the reason that they wrote that, the whole idea was, okay, we're not going to do that stuff, so we'll write it down and we'll bury it. So that was the reason that they found it. It also, by the way, proves that the Paleo-Hebrew alphabet that we've been using is the earliest alphabet, because the only contender was Phoenician, and this predates the Phoenician by many, many, many centuries.
Fabulous.
Wow. So how about them apples?
Great, great. How about them apples?
Yeah, so that's...
Them aleph. How about them aleph?
How about them alephs? Yeah. All right, so as we delve deeper into the book of Yaqutzel, Yaqutzel means God's groves, more commonly known as Ezekiel. The reason we've been sharing... jumped ahead to covering this, is that I had thought that what we had read in Yeshayah, where God was condemning rabbis and Judaism right up to the last day, was about as harsh as anything we would ever encounter.
Mm-hmm.
And then we read Zechariah, and it was harsher still.
Pretty tough, yeah.
And then we read Hosea, and it was harsher still. And now we're reading Yaqutzel, and, I mean, he goes all the way to say that you're shit-faced. Excuse me, but that's what he says. You are...
Yeah, that's what he says, yeah.
Bullshit. I guess I can use the term, because Yahweh used the term. He says, as far as I'm concerned, that's what you look like to me. That's his view of Judaism. And don't think for a moment, we talked about this last week, that you get an out if you're a Christian or if you're a Muslim. Your religion's worse. The only reason God calls out Judaism more often than he does Christianity is because Judaism directly corrupts God's people, and he cares more about his people than he cares about mm-hmm. anyone else.
Gentiles, certainly.
So Torah appears five more times in the prophetic proclamations Yahweh revealed through Yaqutzel beyond where we had already read. And while God's message remains consistent, the next three times Torah is scribed, we're given a unique and especially revealing perspective from God. It's not surprising. Torah means teaching. It means guidance. So we would expect God to operate in this way. This next time, Yahweh has allowed his prophet to see his return. God says more about his return than any other topic, bringing him forward to time, in time, to the beginning of the millennial Shabbat is what Yahweh did on behalf of Yaqutzel. That's the marvelous thing about being a spiritual being is you're akin to light energy. And as light energy, you can see the past, the present, and future simultaneously. He enabled Yakitzel to see the future, to experience the future as it will transpire before us. By reading this prophetic portrait, we can envision what's going to come. We will know who we will find and what it will be like when we arrive. We'll come to appreciate the credentials of those who are going to be admitted, understand what they have considered and accepted, and we're going to learn what we should avoid trying to bring with us, even what would cause us to be excluded, or worse, to be among those who are incinerated. In that light, these, I think, are some of the most revealing words ever spoken or written through a Nabi, a prophet. As the prophet transitions from what he heard God say to describe his return. It begins. This is Yakitzel, Ezekiel 43, beginning with the first statement. He journeyed with me to the entrance, the gate, which is facing east towards the way of the meeting and confrontation. Asher Paneh Derek Ha Gedim, which is to show the way to the benefits of the relationship and provides the path to approach and engage someone or encounter them in a combative way. Then behold, Hahena, the glorious appearance, powerful manifestation, and splendid persona, Kabud, of the God of Yisrael. He was approaching and entering from the way the meeting was anticipated long ago, and thus from the east. His audible voice was similar to the sound of tremendous abundance of water. And then the earth was brilliantly illuminated by his light. Yakitzel 43, 1 and 2. All right, so God's returning. He's going to make a grand entrance.
Mm-hmm.
He's coming through a gate, a doorway, a portal. And that portal into Jerusalem is going to be from the east. Right? Now,
yes.
The reason for the east and not the west is a combination of one is that Yahweh still has to return in spiritual form. He can't return, you know, with his whole nature. He is, in effect, going to be replacing the sun is in terms of light on mm-hmm. our planet. And the sun rises in the east. Yahweh is going to rise above Jerusalem from the east. He's not going to go away or set in the west. He's rising in the east. The east is also describes a time and a place for a meeting. And that mm-hmm. meeting can be embracing or confrontational, which is exactly how he's returning. So this glorious appearance and powerful manifestation and splendid persona, this is God as turned up as much of himself as he is, he's ever allowed on this planet by probably billions of fold. We're going to see God magnificent, powerful, splendid, enriching, great abundance. So this is not going to be the lowly Yosha as the Passover lamb. You know, which he said, there was nothing about his appearance that would impress anybody. This is Yahweh dialed up as much as it is possible and still not incinerate the planet. As a matter of fact, if you are not enveloped in the set-apart spirit, you wouldn't even survive his arrival.
No.
Even still, he doesn't call himself the God of the earth, doesn't call himself the God of the universe. He doesn't call himself the God of gods. He calls himself the God of Yisrael. That's pretty amazing that after all of Yisrael has done to him, that he would still refer to himself as such. He was approaching and entering from the way of the meeting was anticipated long ago and thus from the east. How is it? These words are very clear. Yahweh is coming back. Yahweh is going to appear as brilliant as you can imagine from the east, which means he's going to come down on the Mount of Olives. So if you're the Rambam and you're jotting down the 13 principles of Judaism, how is it you're going to talk about this return of an unknown Messiah when you've got God himself
returning?
What would you care that there's going to be a returning Messiah? Not a returning Messiah. They don't think he's returning. They think a warrior Messiah. What would you care when God himself told you he's coming? Talk about that. Do you hate God so much as a religious Jew that you'd rather have a Bar Kokhba part two? How could you miss this? And if you're a damn Christian and you think that Jesus Christ is going to have a second coming, why do you lug around a book that 80% of it says exactly the opposite? It's Yahweh that's returning. And he's returning exactly as he said he was going to return. The audible sound of his voice will be like the sound of a tremendous abundance of water. Boy, I'm not surprised. I think the most powerful sound is waves crashing against the shore. I live probably 150, 200 yards from the ocean, the beach itself, and looked right down on it, and I live a little further back from it because one of the things you learn is you live on an island is that you don't actually want to be on the water. Water, the beach is wonderful to walk on. It's not great to live in. It's way too caustic. Salt destroys everything. So you want to rebuild your entire home, your rebar inside your walls will even rust out every 15 years or so, then, go right ahead and build it on the sand of the beach. Or you can build it up. You get a nice breeze, life is just much better to look down on it. But one of the things I can hear, I walk outside right now, I can hear the waves crashing on the beach. It's one of my favorite sounds. It's running water. It's marvelous. And so there's something tranquil about it. There's something stimulating about it, something exciting about it. It's soothing. It's just everything. And that's the way we're going to hear Yahweh's voice. And the earth itself will be illuminated with his glorious light. Can you imagine being here when God is the brightest thing in the universe? And you can say, I know him. He's my dad. Look at him.
Hey,
I'm his son. Pretty cool, huh?
Yeah, pretty cool.
Yeah, matter of fact, you can say, hey, yeah, he's just my dad. I'm going to go. he invited me to go sit on the throne next to him here for a while. Excuse me. I'm going to go chat with dad. But true. So even in this glorious moment, Yahweh chose to share it with his prophet, with God and man walking side by side. It was such a simple thing, and yet really very profound in this situation. Kedem conveys far more than east. It speaks of the meeting. Yah was inviting us to attend with him on this day. That would be Yom Kippurim. It also conveys the consequence of failing to respond, which is to be confronted by God. And with Kedem, we learn that the Moed Yahweh is fulfilling had been previously known and anticipated long ago. 3,480 some years to plus or minus a year or two. Further, the reason that he will be approaching from the east is because, as I mentioned, he is descending on the Mount of Olives. Now, he's doing that for a number of reasons. He's going to destroy everything that's on Moriah. The Dome of the Hopi print, you don't want to be anywhere near that sucker or Asuka Mosque. You know, near anything that man has built in the vicinity, God's destroying it all. And so the best view of it is going to be from Olives. I don't know if how many of you have been to Jerusalem, but the best view is really from the top of the Mount of Olives. There's a lovely pull-off there. You stand up there, and now there's a lot of there's less clutter between Olives and Moriah than there's probably any other place in Israel. You got some graves going down the hill and some olive trees and then some graves going back up. Of course, the Muslims, they wanted to be buried by the East Gate because they had read this and they knew that's the way that God was going to return. But that was, you know, the inferior gods to Allahu Akbar. And so those Muslim fighters, when they died, they wanted to be there. So during the Great Resurrection, they would be able to go fight God and keep him from going through the gate. Allahu Akbar.
Good luck, pal.
Yeah, good luck. It's going to work really well for them. And no one said that that Islam made people smart. So, and by the way, the Jews that are buried on Mount of Olives know the same stuff. They read this. They know that Yah was coming back. They want to be the first to see him. But unfortunately, very few of them will. So by choosing this approach, God is emphasizing that he is the dawn of a new day and a time of increasing enlightenment. Yahweh is not the God of Judaism. He's not the God of Christianity. He's the God of Israel.
Israel.
His return is for the remnant of his people, and it will be glorious. Now, I've shared my favorite sounds have always been those of the ocean as waves crash upon the rocks or softly dissipate over the embrace of a sandy beach. The sound of clear mountain streams cascading to the sea, that's music to my ears. So it sounds like the symphony of Yahweh's return will serve as a concerto for those with similar preferences. For those that don't like the sound of running water, which would be like most of your progressives in the state of California would call you a water waster, then you probably wouldn't like Eternity with Yahweh anyway.
It's uncanny. You know, I've been painting. I started back to painting, and I've been painting Tahoe and the river here. The American River, and I went up not too far away. I found the rapids, and I've been painting them and just studying them and producing art from there. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean, I missed it.
Yeah, there's a mountain lake with that one happens to be in the Sierras. It is one of the most spectacular sites. I remember how often I would go to Yosemite, which is Yosemite and Carmel are probably two of my very favorite places in terms of just natural beauty. But the waterfalls in Yosemite Valley, as they plummet over those granite formations, it's one of the great sights. It's so uplifting and inspiring. And so at Lake Tahoe, I've spent a lot of time there. I love mountain lakes. I love the feel, the Christmas of the air and the sun even feels a little different, the warmth on your face with the thinner atmosphere. And that smell of the wind as it blows through the pine trees. It's and I think the whole earth is going to return to the beauty of the Carmel Coast and the High Sierras with its lakes and crystal clear waters. And there's so many other beautiful places around the world that we'll be celebrating. Yep. So even more glorious, the earth itself is going to be bathed in God's brilliant light. And truthfully, there's nothing more beautiful than light. Even here is, you know, I'm sorry if I talk about my own situation a lot, but that's kind of God's way, is he wants us to personalize everything that he says and appreciate it because of that. But I wake up every morning before the sun, and my bedroom's windows overlook the east, and I can actually see the beginnings of the red to glisten off the water. And it is just so magnificent. Light, and particularly in the early mornings as you have the long rays through the palm trees, and the evenings as those long rays again cascade through the trees. This is something, if you like light, if the shades of light are something that are of interest to you. You know, I have two offices here in my home. I spend so much time in them. I decided I was going to indulge myself, and I have a second one now. And they are completely surrounded by windows. So this is something that I've really come to enjoy is light. And it's something that I would encourage everyone who has not developed a love affair with light and with water to explore these things, because these are things that represent who Yahweh is and how we're going to see him. You are an artist, so there's no chance that you haven't considered Notice. The ramifications of light, because light is everything. I'm not sure there's anything other than light as it relates to art.
That's the key.
Light is color. Light is perspective. Light is shading. Light is contrast.
All the fundamentals. Yes, sir.
It's understanding light that enables you to create a three-dimensional image of a two-dimensional image of a three-dimensional object and have it look real.
Yeah, and be convincing, yes. That's right.
Yeah, it's all
you can teach my class. You're good.
I could. Yeah, sure. I could say, yes, here's my friend Kirk.
and here's the easy part. He'll draw it.
He'll teach you. He'll teach you. It also means that Yah was returning as light and thus as a spiritual being. As such, we'll be witnessing the Ruach Kodesh, the set-apart spirit, arriving in all of her glory. And that is why we will soon see Ezekiel introducing the Ruach and referring to God's presence as she. This continues. This is 43:3. The appearance and the vision was similar to that which I had foreseen, like a sight which I had witnessed when I am returned to the ravaged inhabitants of the corrupt shrines. This vision was the same as the revelation I had perceived by the Kabar waterway. The glorious presence of Yahweh entered into the family home by way of the gate, which is facing east towards the way of meeting or confronting her. Then the Ruach spirit lifted me up, and she brought me to God's presence within the inner court. And behold, the family home was filled with the glorious manifestation of Yahweh's presence. There is this tendency to refer to the building as the first temple, Solomon's temple, second temple, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, God's
yeah.
terminology is actually home, family, Be'eth, is the term that he uses most. He has a term for sanctuary, which basically means set apart. He has a term for tabernacle that basically means brilliant tent or temporary residence. But his favorite is Be'eth, which is family home. It's the basis of Be'ereth, which is covenant. And so Ezekiel is telling us that when he's brought into the presence of Yahweh, he is carried there by the set-apart spirit, which means he's enveloped and protected so that he is seen as light, and, you know, light to light, there is no carnage, where if he just went in as a mortal being, that much light would incinerate him. So he goes in,
yes.
He's protected by the set-apart spirit, he's carried into God's presence by the set-apart spirit. I even think that mom's doing introductions.
Mm-hmm. Hey, that makes sense.
This is Ezekiel. He looks perfect to me. But you guys might want to chat. So that is the kind of experience. So it's all in a family home. And when we talk about when he talks about the inner court, he's talking about bringing this man right into his home. And God is consistent. Means if he took Yaketzel to the future to show his return on Kippurim and brought him into this home that he is reestablishing on the on Moriah, then he's going to do the same for us.
Mm-hmm.
We can expect God to treat his covenant children exactly as he treated Yaketzel. And so we would also expect the Ruach Kodesh to embrace us the same way. So few things are as important to our understanding of God and to our relationship with him as this realization. Yahweh is Bo Ba Be'eth. He's coming home. He's returning to his family. God's priority is his Be'ereth, his covenant, which is why he's entering his home and filling it with his presence. And this means that it is Yahweh, not Jesus, who is coming. And the realization is that he is Bo, returning here, means that he's been here before. By the way, when Moshe came down from the mountain,
mm-hmm.
What did they say about his face?
He was glowing like light. It covered up, I think.
Yep, that's exactly what we're going to look like.
Yeah.
Yep. In this regard, readers have been done a tremendous disservice by Bible translators when they carelessly misrepresented Yahweh's Be'ereth, Hamley Home, as a temple. And you will read this passage and they'll say, brought into the inner court of the temple.
Mm-hmm.
Be'eth is home. They know Be'eth is home. Why mistranslate it?
You know, I counted 300 and something times before it's ever called temple. They know it's not. They know it's family home. It's malfeasance.
Yeah, I think the reason they don't want it to be a family home is if
it's
a family home. And the
yeah.
covenant is based on this word, so it's a family relationship. Then how do you get a religion? How do you worship a dad?
Yeah.
How do you worship your mom?
Yeah, can't do it.
Where's the room for a bunch of laws and fearsome and praying
yeah.
and worship?
How can you fear the Lord?
If you're in a family and a home.
Yeah.
There are no lords in homes. So I think that's why they don't want it.
Absolutely. I agree. Has to be.
A home is a place to be loved and to grow, whereas a temple is typically a place to bow down and worship. As a result of accurately rendering Be'eth, we now know our Heavenly Father's preference, which is to love and to grow, not to bow down and be worshipped. Ruach is a feminine noun. The spirit represents the maternal aspects of Yahweh's nature, particularly in her interactions with the covenant family. The Ruach of Yahweh is our spiritual mother. She is our counselor. So next, Yaquetzal sets an example, and it's one that we might want to follow. It reads, "Then I listened to the one speaking to me from the family home." Once again, Habayeth. "This individual came to be present standing beside me, and he spoke as God to me." Well, that's a pretty good start. Standing side by side with God. That is the picture that we have just looking at Yahweh's name with those two people standing in the midst, right beside his outstretched hands. So the voice speaking came across as an individual. So we're not, yes, this individual just happened to be God. But the first impression was, he's somebody like me. Why? How could you ever be in a position where you would view God as someone like you? Because it's God's intent to make us ever more
like
him.
Yeah.
So this is really a profound thing. The first thing he says is that this individual came to be present beside me. Etzelani. What a wonderful picture. The creator God of the universe is standing beside Yaquetzal. Buddy to buddy, shoulder to shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And he spoke as God to me. Son of Adam. Son of man. This place where I am standing is the home of my throne. And in association with this place, the soles of my feet stand firmly. Happily, as a result of the relationship, I will dwell here in this place where my name endures. In the midst of the children of Yisrael forevermore. And the family of Yisrael shall never again besmirch or corrupt my set apart name. They or their religious or political leaders and advisors with their unfaithfulness and spiritual adultery or with their leaders, shrines to worship their corpses.
Pretty clear.
So, Yahweh has presented, this is what's going to happen. This is how I'm going to be perceived when I arrive back home. Me coming, not sending an emissary, I'm coming back, and I'm coming to my home, and I'm going to be as brilliant as light. I'm going to sound like rushing waters. This is the scene. And I'm coming back as the God of Yisrael. I'm coming back for the remnant of my people. Those who survive to this moment are going to experience God as a friend, as dad, as someone standing right beside them. And we're going to engage in conversation. And here God says, this is my home, my seat of honor. And an association with this place, this is where I take my stand. Once again, we have one more statement that presents this as, well, if we were dealing with the blessings and cursings, this is the last of the blessings. Happily, as a result of the relationship, Asher, I will dwell here in this place where my name endures. In the midst of the children of Yisrael, the offspring who engage and endure with God forevermore, tells you that while God's going to create a new heavens and a new universe, new earth, new everything, the one thing that's going to endure is Jerusalem. I think it becomes essentially a hypercube. It's got the three dimensions that we know of, but it becomes infinite in time, probably a sixth, ultimately, could even be a seven-dimensional version of Yahweh's ideal version of Jerusalem. So this is something that's going to continue to endure. Yahweh's home is going to be comprised of light. Dothan's home is going to be the next one down the hill. There's going to be a giant stream of running waters between the two, probably a bridge of light that connects them. All the family is going to be coming and going, exploring the universe, coming home. I think that Yahweh's version of Jerusalem, as he intends it, and his home there, the family home for the covenant, is going to endure forever, even when God creates a new universe. And that it is literally incorporated into the seven dimensions of heaven. Because it's the only way that God can endure with the children of Israel forevermore is for him to incorporate it into the seventh dimension, because the sense dimensions of the universe as we know it, he's going to extinguish and create a new version in our presence. So this means that Jerusalem is incorporated into the seventh dimension. It becomes a hypercube.
Wow.
Now, that's the end of the good news. Well, actually, I think this is also good news. It's just that if you're on the other side of this line, you wouldn't like it so much. The reason I think it's good news is I'm disgusted by the religious. I think playing religious dress-up, acting out religious, whether you're shooting automatic rifles at women and children and screaming Allahu Akbar, or you're celebrating those who do, or you're wearing a black mourning coat and treating your wife like she's worthless and indoctrinating your kids and essentially cursing Yahweh's name, writing it out of your religion, pretending that you're the opposite of who you are, that's every bit as disgusting. So to have them gone is a good thing. And so the family of Yisrael shall never again besmirch or corrupt my set apart name. So the very first thing that God says for the second time now, when he returns, the first thing he's saying is, my name will never be corrupted again. You know, when in Yeshayah, he says, when he returns, the one thing I will never have to hear again is me being called the Lord. It will never be on their lips again. Same thing here in Yaketzel. So God has all the things you would expect Yahweh to say. Wow, you know, I'm here with my people. We're having a great time. Party hardy. Going to have great feasts, great wine, great songs, great stories to tell. Go off, explore the universe. Oh, are we going to have fun? The first thing he says is, I am never, ever going to have my people besmirch or corrupt my name ever again. Wow. So how important is
about that name
is annoying him?
Yeah.
How angry is God at religious Jews, rabbis,
totally,
for writing his name out of his Torah? They or their religious and political leaders and advisors, Wabalak, with their unfaithfulness and spiritual adultery, their harlotry, their whoredom, or with their leaders' shrines to the worship of their corpses. Boy, is this ever true. One of the reasons there's so many Jews in the Ukraine is because they want to worship the grave sites and everything there is to do with Baal Shem Tov.
Wow.
Yeah. Why is there Israel? The founder of Hasidic Judaism. And they have these tubes that all over the world and all over Israel, all over Babylon, all over the Ukraine, they worship their dead. It is amazing the reverence that religious Jews have to rabbis. And they revere them in life, revere them in death. They do everything but revere God. And so God's saying, you know, they can have all their shrines to the worship of their dead. One of the really the many marvelous benefits of Yahweh revealing these conversations through his Navi is that we can listen in. We can experience what transpired as if we were there. Indeed, because of these prophecies, we too are transported in time to witness their fulfillment right along with Yahkatzel. I don't know if there's really much difference between having this word's eye view of the future and actually being there. In a lot of ways, I like this better. This way, we can visualize in our minds exactly what we're going to see, what we're going to feel, what we're going to think, what we're going to experience, anticipate it, which is such a marvelous thing. Be aware of it so that it's not shocking, it's not surprising. It's very comfortable because it's exactly what we expect. We can share it so that there'll be more people there to appreciate it. We can understand it so it's not doesn't just come on us as a surprise. We try to figure it out. No, we know it in advance, and we know exactly why it's happening this way. We've thought about it. We've discussed it. We've envisioned it. We've anticipated it. I think what we get to do here is vastly better than what Yahkatzel experienced.
And we can do it over and over.
We can read it over and over. We can learn at whatever pace we wish to learn. Now, the reason that Yahweh Ahmad stood beside his prophet is to make a point. God wants us on our feet. He wants us standing and walking. He wants us Estelle beside him. This is the perspective combined with God Bo returning to enter his home and fill it with his or light that, of course, speaks volume as to who he is, what he's offering, and what he wants from us. Such a small thing, so powerful. Yahweh's words are such that,
yes.
I think we began this program on 5 pages ago,
mm-hmm.
and it's an hour and 45-minute program. This isn't a track meet. It's not about how fast you get to the end. It's how deep you dive.
Savor the meal.
Savor it. Enjoy it. You can learn so much from each word if you're willing to linger. You know, think about it, ponder it, examine it. And so in this case, we can picture ourselves there. Now, Yahweh spoke of his kiseh, which is his throne, his seat of honor. Why? Because he wants to share it with us. While his son and our Messiah, Dod, get first dibs, there will be ample time for each of us to snuggle up and sit down alongside our Heavenly Father. I want to mention something about Messiah because I've been spending a lot of time in the last 2 weeks. That's really been all I have translated. I finally got around to, now I'm translating the third chapter or fourth chapter, whatever it is, of volume 7 of Yeshaya now. And it's about the Daniel 9 prophecy that Christians say this is the prophecy that would have caused Peter to say, you are the Christ, you know, to recognize Jesus
mm-hmm.
as the Messiah. And so I've been doing a lot of study on that subject. And, you know, one of the things that I came to, several things came to realize. One is there is no predicted Messiah. There is no way that that fisherman would have said, oh, yeah, I recognize you. You're the guy they were talking about as the coming Messiah. There is no such prophecy. As a matter of fact, of the things that are anointed, people are very rare with the exception of Aaron and his sons. Aaron and his sons are anointed regularly and discussed regularly because of the service they are providing on Yahweh's behalf for his people inside of his home. And so to go into where the Ark of the Covenant is and to do all the things symbolically that show the way to God through the Moed Mikre, he wants them anointed. He wants his tabernacle, his home anointed. He wants his menorah anointed. He wants the table anointed. He wants it all anointed. These are things, all of which are set apart, all of which are separating, all of which are uncommon and unique and special to God. So it is things primarily that are anointed. And so if you want to be anointed, you have to identify with the breadth of things that Yahweh chose to anoint, special blend of olive oil. You know, those things are the things that he has set apart and most set apart. His home, the inner room, the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant, and all of the accoutrements inside of his home. And if you don't associate with those, you might as well just throw away the whole concept of anointing, because that's what the Torah teaches. So when the Torah is teaching about anointing, it is Aaron and his sons. And that would mean if you're going to be along the Messianic line, you'd have to be a Lowi Cohen priest, of which Jesus most certainly was not. And there was actually no Jesus, but Yosha, the Passover lamb. Guess what is never anointed? Passover lamb. Now, there are some people that are anointed. There are one general who became a king, one king that became a son, a king that became a retrobate, and a king that was not actually anointed but called anointed. He just never had the oil, and he was a pagan. And then there was a king that the people chose that Yahweh said, this is a really, really bad idea, but I'm going to give him every opportunity to succeed. And finally, Yahweh said, I can't stand it anymore, pulled his spirit away from him, and allowed Satan to torment him. That was Shaul, King Saul.
If
you're going to then ascribe your religion, and Christianity calls this their religion by this supposed translation of anointed and Christo and Christian. So they're going to name their God this thing, and they're going to call themselves by this thing, that of those who are actually people who are anointed, most all of them were scallywags. It is not a title one would ascribe to. I mean, you got the first person that's anointed is Aaron. Well, if there ever was a scallywag, it's Aaron. I mean, Aaron tried to usurp God's relationship with Moshe. I mean, that's stupid.
Yeah.
And then he goes off. Moshe's up getting the Torah, and he goes, hey, I got a good idea. Let's take all this wealth that God gave us leaving Egypt, and let's make an idol, a golden calf. I mean,
what was he thinking?
Aaron is a scallywag. So he's the first person anointed. You don't want to be associated with that. The next guy anointed,
no.
Other than his sons, was King Shaul, who God says,
Shaul.
I hate this guy. And I'm pulling my spirit from him. And I'm going to allow Satan to do whatever he wants to with him. That's not good. Dode, okay, Dode. Good dude, man. He is anointed by God. Okay. You know of Dode's resume. Dode has a pretty good resume. King of Israel, defender of Israel, uniter of Israel, guy who acquired the site, the threshing floor where the home of Yahweh would be. Yahweh's favorite singer. Yahweh's shepherd. The branch, King of Israel, King of Kings, giant slayer, I mean, author of the song, songwriter of God's preference, Son of God.
Taking those names. Mean, yeah.
Guy's got an ultimate resume, right?
Oh, yeah.
Do you know
yeah.
that Messiah is okay. I was anointed. But even in his summation of this is who I am, he starts with prophet, saying, you know, first and foremost, I was a prophet. And he concludes with songwriter. And the fact he was anointed is just one of the things in between. So, and that's as good as it gets. Solomon was anointed, but oh my God, look what happened to his life. And then, of course, that Cyrus was called God's anointed because he had business to do through him. But Cyrus was an egotistical, murdering pagan. So why would you seek that title? No,
for your maker God.
It's not a preferential title anywhere in the Torah and prophets. The process of being anointed is significant, but there is no mention that the Christian Jesus was anointed. You can't be anointed in water. It's with olive oil. And if this title was so damn important to him, why in the heck didn't they write in? I mean, they've got a whole story of Gabriel, who is a mythical creature in the New Testament, and John the Baptist, another mythical creature, and all sorts of mythology about the two of them. Why, if him being the Christ was such a big deal, did they not anoint him? But he's not anointed. He's not the Christ. He's not a Messiah. The last thing I did is was talking about Yeshaya 9. Because if you're going to talk about Messiah, you don't go beyond Dode. In terms of Yahweh, the rest of them are diddly-eyed dead. And Yahu, the commander that Yahweh had anointed by Elia, he was anointed by Elia for a particular mission. He was a general that Yahweh said, I want everything associated with Jezebel and her husband, King, and everything associated with Baal worship and Asherah worship obliterated. And so he killed them all. So that guy was anointed, but he was a warrior. So why would you pick that title? You know, it's not a particularly good one. Being anointed on Yahweh's instructions for a particular purpose is a marvelous thing. Being a Messiah, not so much. And then you go to Yeshaya 9, which is an ode to Dode. I mean, nothing in it applies to Yosha. Everything in it applies to Dode. Dode's name is actually mentioned. Yosha's name is not mentioned. But in that, if this was supposed to be the big announcement of a child is born, a son is given, blah, 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 and he shall be so wonderful, what's not mentioned in it? Anointed.
Anointed Messiah.
Well, if that's going to be his last name, if you're going to name your religion based on it, don't you think it would have gotten an honorable? There are a whole lot of things mentioned in there. It goes on and on and on and on and on about the credentials of this individual who happens to be Dode. Never doesn't even mention Messiah. Why? Because it's not among the important things on Dode's resume. Pretty cool to have a resume where you happen to be the Messiah. And it's
that's true.
It doesn't even get an honorable mention.
Oh well.
So it's just astounding. Anyway, so I did translate everything that Gabriel had to say to Danielle, and turns out that most everything in that list that he said was going to happen. I'm going to bring an end to religion. I'm going to stop prophecy. Whoa. I'm going to bring ultimate reconciliation. almost everything on that list has not happened yet. Almost everything on that list will happen in 2033 when Yahweh returns in your 6,000 Yah. Almost everything on that list is about what will happen, with some of it pertaining to what has happened. As it turns out, that whole prophecy is, I'm going to give you the first day that I'm going to begin the fulfillment of the seven most important days. And the seven most important days are going to be fulfilled in two periods of time that's going to start in your 4,000 Yah by walking into Jerusalem as the Passover lamb 4 days before Passover. And I'm going to give you the exact date that I'm going to arrive. So you'd have to be an idiot to miss the arrival of the Passover lamb. Well, of course, the Jews did.
They did. Yeah, of course.
They did. But he gave the exact day I'm going to come in as the Passover lamb. And then the things that are being fulfilled, he speaks specifically of the fulfillment of matzah and of the benefits of Bikurim, and particularly of Shavuah. And then speaks that there's another seven out there, where he points to the future, to the last 7 years, where he's going to fulfill the last three Moed Mikre, and he speaks vociferously about fulfilling in particular Kippurim. It is about the fullness of time as we move from your 4,000 Yah to 6,000 Yah. And what Gabriel's trying to do, my first time when I went through this again, I said, oh my God, this is the most complicated run-on sentence in the history of complicated run-on sentences. Not that I can complain, because I'm pretty good at run-on sentences, but you're just saying, oh my goodness. You can't equate this to a single day. Most of it hasn't happened yet. I move that we demote Gabriel and we bring back Yahweh and let Yahweh communicate his prophetic insights directly to the prophets and not go through Malak, because this is way too complicated. Then I decided to do something. And that is that he mentions not once but twice Mashiach to be anointed. So I said, maybe what I need to do is study in the Torah what Yahweh had to say about anointing, and to see if when you study anointing, it explains the prophecy. Son of a gun. When particularly in Shemoth names Exodus, Yahweh's introducing us to the concept, he goes right on through everything on that prophecy. And so it's like Gabriel said, I'm going to give you a prophecy that if you're a Torah observant, you're going to understand everything that I'm saying. And if you're not Torah observant, you don't have a prayer. And it turns out to be very exciting, because you can unravel all of it just by being Torah observant. But let's be clear. There is one Messiah. I probably overemphasized the use of the term when applied to, because I want Yisrael to know, since they're so fixated on this arrival of their Messiah and so fixated on being certain that Yosha wasn't the Messiah. And in both cases, they're just flat out wrong. It's true. Yosha was not the Messiah. But there isn't an unknown Messiah that's coming. It is Dode who is coming, and if they know Dode is the Messiah, then that's at least a point of contact to encourage them to begin to drift back home. But let's be clear. It's not among Dode's most important titles. The most important title of Dode, far and away, is Son of God.
Yeah.
And then after that is King of Kings. And even when he is speaking of anointing Dode, Samuel, who is the one following Yah's instructions to go find him, and he finds him, of course, then in Bethlehem, tending sheep. He was God right at the outset says, "I want you to go with a horn filled with olive oil because we're going to anoint him." And in the discussion of anointing, he said filled them with an exceptional degree of the Ruach Kodesh, the set apart spirit, and that she stayed with him forever. So this direct connection between Shemuel anointing him with olive oil and the set-apart spirit coming upon him. So it's a marvelous story, and there is enormous insight into Yahweh's preference for this particular boy who would grow to be a man, and how God says, my criterion is different than everybody else's, and then how all that fits back into the prophecy that Christians have usurped to claim for their Jesus, to give their mythological Jesus credibility. And, you know, even though we are speaking on behalf of Yehudim, and I forgot to mention our social media outreach this week is in Detroit. So thank you so much, Dee, for arranging that. I apologize for not mentioning it earlier. But it is a focal point, because amongst the greatest crimes ever perpetrated by Yehudim was the failure to recognize the Passover lamb. Because fulfilling Passover is the very thing Yahweh told Abraham and Yishak he was going to do. He was going to provide the lamb. And 40 obels to the day that he told that to Abraham and Yishak on that very same mountain, Moriah, exactly 40 obel, Pesach to Pesach, he did what he said. And he even told Daniel the exact day the Passover lamb would walk into the
mm-hmm.
home.
I've done that, yeah.
And to not recognize the Passover lamb means that you miss the whole significance of what God promised to do. And you miss the significance of how he fulfilled matzah and bikurim and shabuah. You missed it all. And you became so belligerent trying to prove that guy that the Christians had this dying and resurrecting myth associated with was not the Messiah, that you buried the concept of the Passover lamb and missed it. One of the greatest crimes ever perpetrated. If you had known he was the Passover lamb, if you knew it was Yahweh fulfilling that promise, there never would have been a Christianity. Never would have been an Islam. You would never have been booted from the promised land. So this is a really important concept to drive home. Well, anyway, this time next week we'll be celebrating Pesach. We'll dedicate our show to it. We'll return to this at a later date. But I think it's important that we do our next program on Pesach, and maybe the following week on Matzah. Doing this with you, I will have olive oil and herb, lamb and wine breath when I do the show this time next week. So all of you be prepared.
Right back at you.
If I have a little too much wine, you will now know my excuse.
Just slur your words.
Like it's my favorite night of the year. I have to tell you that Pesach is just really special to me. I know I should be far more excited about matzah, and this year I'm going to make matzah Pesach, a second Pesach, but there's just something about the first day of Chag Matzah and the celebration of Passover. I love the symbolism of the matzah and the olive oil and the bitter herbs, and of course of the lamb and the wine, and it is such a beautiful meal and a beautiful experience. So that's what we're doing next week at this time. So may Yah bless.
Okay.
Look forward to being with you at this time next week. And thank you,
me too.
Kirk. My pleasure to be with you all.
Thank
Shabbat
you.
Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. Good night.